It used to be that you had to break into a safe or chloroform a guard or something that required a little exercise in order to get at personal information, secret business operations, state secrets. But some very clever and determined people are finding it all too easy these days to do the equivalent on the Internet without leaving their apartments. With some skill, knowledge, and patience, you too might be able to hack into someone's Twitter account, steal valuable data from a business, or sabotage a government's computer network. Not that we recommend that sort of thing. Keeping those kind of things from happening is called cybersecurity, and it's our topic on Focus Today. Our guests both work in the cybersecurity field at the University of Illinois. Michael Korn is the Chief Information Security Officer for the university, and Roy Campbell is a U of I computer science professor. I'm Jim Meadows, and cybersecurity is the topic on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. If you've ever had one of your online accounts hacked into, or if perhaps you've ever answered an email and ended up regretting it, you might want to call our email to this program today because we'd like to hear about it. You're certainly not alone if you've ever been a victim of any sort of cyber crime. You're part of a growing group of people, businesses, governments that thought their online records and controls were secure. Our guests today are familiar with the problem. Michael Korn has two jobs in connection with cybersecurity at the University of Illinois. He's Chief Privacy and Security Officer at the Urbana campus and Chief Information Security Officer for the entire U of I system. And good morning, Michael. Welcome to Focus.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And on the phone is Roy Campbell. He's a computer science professor on the Urbana campus. And he's involved, among other things, with the Information Trust Institute at the U of I, working on a new college curriculum on digital forensics. And Professor Campbell, welcome to Focus.
Good morning.
I wanted maybe just start with that particular project. I understand you received a grant late last year, you and others at the Information Trust Institute, to work on this new curriculum.
That's right. It's becoming quite a problem to create enough manpower with technical skills to be able to address all the issues. The cell phones have added to that problem. That cell phones are now becoming very interesting objects to study in relationship to crime and so on. And the forensics really help with that.
And by forensics, what do we mean there?
So you're looking for digital evidence that a particular event has occurred in the past. And the evidence has to be presentable to a law court. So you need a chain of custody to actually argue the case. And what you're really looking for is a solid evidence that a device, electronic device, and the media stored on it has been engaged in some activity.
So you're essentially looking at a way to train the people who will be doing this for us in the future.
Absolutely. One of the problems is that computer scientists don't know anything about the legal process, and the legal folks don't know anything about the computer inside. So you need some way to bridge between the two. It's interdisciplinary.
Well, Michael Korn, is digital forensics part of what you do, or are you more dealing with other aspects of cybersecurity?
Digital forensics is a growing part of what we do. We have a forensics lab and a couple of staff members that are trained in digital forensics, certified in it. And we find increasingly it's, you know, when I think back about 8-9 years ago, we really didn't do a whole lot of forensics. Now we do it quite regularly, and in fact, we turn down requests frequently from some of the regional law enforcement to assist them with it, because we're not, you know, supported to provide that service to all the various law enforcement agencies. But increasingly, when we get involved in a case, doing some sort of forensic analysis is quite common.
What sort of cases are you working on for the university? What tends to come down the pike?
They sort of fall into two categories. The first is sometimes when there's a compromise of a computer, and if that computer has sensitive data on it, say a social security number or something like that, or grades, we're obligated to look and see whether that data itself was taken or manipulated in some fashion. So we'll examine the machine to try to determine if the particular attack touched that information or took that information. On another direction, we'll sometimes be involved with individuals who have hacked websites or other computers, and we're looking for evidence on their computer that would incriminate their activity.
So the compromise of computers might be essentially outside jobs.
Yes.
A lot of cases, or most, or only some?
Well, the vast majority of attacks against the campus are from the outside. And it's worth saying that we see, you know, sometimes people ask me, do you ever have a cyber attack against the campus? And it's important to point out we are under continuous cyber attack from the Internet. Millions of scans looking for vulnerable machines occur every day.
To everybody? Or is the U of I a particular target?
Universities are somewhat of a target simply because we tend to have very soft exteriors. We don't have the rigor of locking everything down that, say, a financial institution might. But on the other hand, we don't have quite the interest to, say, the Russian mob that a financial institution would. We're not as interesting a target from them from a theft standpoint.
But this is not just part of any wholesale attacks of people looking for something anywhere.
They're
thinking the U of I want to go there.
Both sides of it. And in fact, a lot of what we see is sort of workaday stuff. Hackers are simply scanning for vulnerable machines to take over and using as part of their own attack on other places. Sometimes they're looking for sensitive data like, again, social security numbers or bank account information. Lately, we've been putting a lot of thought into the question of intellectual property. We have an awful lot of faculty that are working on some very interesting projects on this campus, and some of those projects may be of interest to foreign governments or professional hackers. So we're trying to address both sets of problems at the same time.
Now, are you also looking at hacking that may be going on campus?
Mm-hmm. Quite a bit. We have got a lot of there's two things to think about from that perspective. One is you do have machines on campus that have been co-opted by somebody from off campus. So you have a compromised machine, someone from off campus will use it to go further into campus. The other is you have the occasional, let's just say, misguided individual who's using a campus resource, say to try to get at financial information or other personal information on campus.
And Professor Campbell, I was wondering, is this stuff we were talking about a new curriculum that you're working on, but is this stuff that you're teaching about in courses you have now?
We do actually teach about password security and other forms of security in security courses at the university. For digital forensics will be more incorporating issues about how you deal with the legal issues of inspecting and looking at other people's machines. Because in order to be able to investigate a crime or investigate an attack, one also needs to be able to negotiate all of the legal issues in inspecting somebody else's machine. So there's a lot of intricate law that needs to be taught in order for the computer scientists to be able to go at, or whoever, the digital, I shouldn't say, but the forensics experts to go ahead and do that process. One of the things I'd like to add to Mike's comments is that now one has to correlate information between machines and between networks and machines, that one has a whole set of different places one can look for digital evidence. One needs to correlate across all of those different systems in order to get a really good case for producing evidence that some event has occurred.
That's a really excellent point, Roy. One of the biggest challenges we have is that when we're investigating an incident, our network is so large and there are so many computers on it that frequently we have to combine data from half a dozen different sources and try to correlate that. And just managing that logistically is quite a challenge for us.
In some ways, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack.
Yep.
If you're looking at packets that flow through the network, it's incredibly difficult.
We're on the On Focus with Roy Campbell, computer science professor here at the U of I Urbana campus, and Michael Korn, who is the chief information security officer for the U of I and the chief privacy and security officer for the U of I Urbana campus. We're talking about cybersecurity, and we welcome you to the conversation as well, including any tales you have to tell about being a cybercrime victim. Just call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Michael, I was wondering about things that go on just on the level of people's email on campus, and how much of the problems that you have to deal with involve, you know, that level of communication.
Quite a bit. It used to be a much larger problem in the sense that when I started in this job, the primary way malicious traffic, you know, viruses, things like that, got onto campus was through email. But I believe it was 04 when we when Sites deployed a spam control system for the campus.
And Sites, we should understand, I'm trying to remember the exact initials.
Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services.
Thank you very much. And they essentially, they run the computer network for the university.
Run the network and the most of the large services for the campus, so such as email. At that point in time, in 04, we also began scanning the incoming email stream for viruses. And to give you a sense, I haven't checked on this lately, but the typical numbers were on the order of 150,000, 200,000 viruses deleted from the email stream every month. So it gives you a sense there was a lot of incoming traffic. What we're seeing now has happened is less that viruses are going on, but we're seeing a lot of what are called phishing attacks.
And phishing attacks are just an email that looks like it's from a trustworthy source, maybe your bank, perhaps?
Precisely. We have seen these crafted to look like they came from the UIUC Credit Union, for example.
How convincing do they look?
It depends. They must be convincing enough because a fair number of people click on them. Mm-hmm. Having said that, if you pay attention, and I think that's the issue, most people simply don't read them with a skeptical eye. If you pay attention, you'll see frequently they look pretty bogus. They'll have come from a non-university email account. Sometimes it's an overseas email account. It'll provide you with a URL. And if you look at the URL you're clicking on, it may initially appear to look like a university URL, but the actual place you're going may be off campus, for example. And no legitimate financial institution, no legitimate branch of the university will ever say, please send me your login credentials, your login and password. And usually what these things are doing is they're trying to get your credentials. Now, there's two problems here. When you click on one of these things or go to one of these sites, there's sort of two things that could happen. One is it could download some virus to your computer that basically starts sending out a similar phishing email to everyone in your contact list. The other thing is that you may actually go to the site and provide your login and password, but you're really providing it to the criminals, at which point they may use your account to harvest it for banking information, personal information, or they may use your email account to send out additional phishing emails. And what's happened recently is we're having a major uptick of these phishing events coming to campus. Many of them are caught by the spam system, but enough get through because we're a very big institution that a people's machine gets compromised, and then it begins sending out hundreds of additional phishing emails. What happens then is certain large companies out on the internet go, I see a lot of malicious traffic coming from the Urbana campus. I'm going to black hole the Urbana campus. And what that means is they flag us as an untrusty source of email. And so, for example, recently a large company has been doing this, flagging the Urbana campus as untrustworthy.
And the Urbana campus more so than, say, other university campuses?
Oh, there are thousands of institutions on these lists. Uh-huh. And universities tend to be on these lists a lot. They go on and off of it because we have very open networks again. So what happens is other institutions subscribe to these lists of bad institutions and start blocking the email from there. So in the last couple of days, I've received a number of emails from various units on campus saying, I can't send email to Lockheed Martin, or I can't send email to Penn State because they're blackholing us. So we're working really hard right now to try to get ourselves off those black hole lists and to put into place some additional controls to prevent this from happening.
And it sounds like you're talking about an uptick in phishing messages coming in, but are people getting smarter about them as far as not using them?
I'd like to believe people are smarter about it, but the fact that we still have people who use them is a sign that we're not doing enough. We're about to launch over this week a large communications campaign to try to remind the community to be sensitive about these things.
A lot of this comes down to passwords and addresses and passwords. That's what often the phishers are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk with both of you about a proposal that came in from Matt Honan, who was the writer for Wired magazine, who wrote at length about his being hacked to the degree that it really shut down his ability to operate on the Internet for a while, and also ended up with him losing a lot of his own personal data. He was able to communicate with the hacker or one of the hackers, and if that person is to be believed, all they really wanted was, I think, his cool-looking Twitter handle and not really anything much else. I don't know how much you can depend on that reply for.
I'd be surprised if it's not true. There's sort of multiple segments to the hacker community. I mean, you do have your state actors coming out of certain countries. You have your Russian mob type people, these very highly trained professionals. But you also have a demographic of mostly younger people who are doing it primarily because they think it's kind of fun. They're doing it for bragging rights within the hacker community.
Professor Campbell is from what you see as you develop this digital forensics curriculum, is that really a big part of the problem? It's not like really organized institutional groups on some other side of the fence that's trying to get through, but people doing it in some ways for fun.
Well, you actually raise a very serious topic. The threat from outside entities, from crime syndicates and so on, and from governments that want to do particular things, is very great and very real. And you can appreciate perhaps the difficulty there that ordinary school children, hackers, whatever, can cause a lot of trouble, and a real organization that was run by significant financial backing could really sort of cause major problems on the Internet. The current issue that on the blacklists of a company being blacklisted in Holland demonstrates that the company then issued, or people associated with the company, I should say, but not necessarily directly, issued a denial of service attack against the blacklisting company.
Right.
So it becomes, you know, almost like warfare. And what is observed is that groups of ordinary hackers, you know, everybody, everyday folks, have joined in some of these efforts. Concerted efforts, almost like a flash crowd.
Yeah.
And that causes all sorts of problems as well. So this has really become a significant problem for everybody. And I think the article that's in Wired should be on everybody's reading list. It really stems from the complexity of the systems we've built, because he was finding interactions between different authentication schemes and different messaging schemes. And the criminals, or the people causing him a problem, were exploiting those interconnections in order to be able to break into his accounts and do the things they wanted to do.
And it's really too bad because the feature Roy's talking about, the ability to use one login and password to log into your Gmail account and your bank account and all these other accounts, it's very attractive. People use dozens, you know, I think the average person probably has two or three dozen accounts online they use. And the desire to link those so that you can log into one and move between them, it's very attractive, but it means that that escalates the or raises the value of that credential and why you have to protect it so well.
And it would be the same if you were using the same lock combination
everywhere
at a variety of sources or the same key for to unlock a variety of things. But of course, you don't have to memorize. Well, maybe the lock combination, but it does get tempting in that, and since it's not a solid object, your computer security file, it's easy to remember how valuable it is.
Well, and I think what's fascinating about the articles you're referencing is it's true that modern computer technology allows hackers to guess a password a whole bunch of times until they get it right. Most of the institutions like Illinois, we have rules that say your password has to be, you know, letters, characters, uppercase, lowercase. This makes it more difficult to guess. But what's fascinating in their case is that they socially engineered their way to control the initial account. So they didn't just sit down at a computer and say, maybe your password is fish, maybe it's Ralph, you know. They called Apple and pretended to be the person and had just enough information, and Apple's processes around validating who you are over the phone were weak enough that they were able to successfully impersonate the individual.
And one of the difficulties is when you sign up for a particular account, some of these details aren't, you don't know what these details are or what the entity would do when it's queried over the telephone. That's not in any sort of description. So you don't really know how valid some of the accounts that you're getting are or how secure they are from the upfront descriptions of them.
And everybody wants to provide good customer service. We face this same question all the time on all the campuses at the university. What are we going to do to validate that who a person is when they call in over the phone and say, I don't remember my password? This is a non-trivial problem, and to be honest, there's no elegant solution for it.
Well, Matt Honan followed up his initial article about being hacked with another article saying that passwords don't work. And the way described, there's two levels of this. And later on, I want to talk with both of you about what you should remember in choosing your passwords. But he says even at their best, they don't really work. And do you think he has a point there?
Roy?
Oh, if the problem is it's the human factors part of the password. The password would work if it was a machine that generated the password and had the login and so on. But humans have to remember passwords, and so they tend to either write them down or put them in one location or want to use the same password or use something that was mnemonic. And unfortunately, that makes each of those provides a vulnerability.
That's right. And what we recommend people do is there are a number of programs out there, and we've got, I don't remember the URL off the top of my head, we do have some recommendations for programs on the site's website that do password vaulting. And basically, these are ways to store passwords securely so that you can use much stronger, much longer, and different passwords for various services. It's a good approach. The other thing he mentions that's very valuable is for some of these services, you can turn on what's called two-factor authentication. This is where you provide a login and password, and then it prompts you for another piece of information. With Google, that piece of information is, I believe, a six-digit PIN that's generated new every minute, and they provide a free app to install on your phone that displays your PIN and changes it every minute. Now, the advantage here is even if I gave you my login and password to my Gmail account, you would have to figure out what that randomly generated six-digit PIN is going to be every minute. And that raises the bar considerably.
unless the hacker is also able to, say, steal your phone with the app on it.
That's right, which goes to why we want you to put a PIN or a password on your phone.
Well, it's time for a short break, and we'll be back with more about cybersecurity with Michael Korn and Professor Roy Campbell. This is Focus on WYLL.
We've both grown tired of running after rain.
Rodney Crowell and Emmylou Harris have known each other for almost 40 years. He was in her band in the mid-70s, but they've just made their first full album as a duo. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with them and hear their music. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Bach's St. Matthew Passion on Saturday, March 30th, beginning at 1 p.m. at Granert. Fred Stoltzfus, the U of I's choral music chair, conducts in his final collaboration with Sinfonia. More information is available at 333-6280.
And we're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're with Michael Korn and Roy Campbell. Michael Korn is the U of I's Chief Information Security Officer, and Professor Roy Campbell is in the Computer Science Department on the Urbana campus. And our subject today is cybersecurity. You can call us with your cybersecurity tales of woe or perhaps suggestions for solutions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus 580, and the phone number again, 333-WYLL, 1-800-222-WILL. We were talking about passwords a few moments ago, and Matt Honan at Wired Magazine made the argument that one reason they don't work, that they're broken in so easily, is people decide their passwords by what they can remember, and that going by one survey, he cited apparently the most used passwords are actually the word password and the number sequence 12345.
That's true. What we do and what increasingly you're finding organizations doing is they are putting checks around your password. Sometimes that simply just informs you, you know, this is weak password, this is a strong password. But many are doing the kind of thing we do, that we run your password against a dictionary, and we make sure it isn't a dictionary word. And many people will use parts of words or an entire word embedded in the password, and all you're doing in those cases is making it easy for people to basically hack your password.
Professor Campbell, I hope your students all have excellently strong passwords. Is this ever a point?
Probably not.
You think there's a bunch of 12345s out there?
I would hope that they're better than 12345, but it's, you know, nowadays people have lists of passwords and accounts, maybe 30 or 40 accounts. Actually, that would be an interesting study. Coming up with unique passwords for each one is very difficult unless you use something like a password vault.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's... So there's difficulty in the complications. But I would also add, there's another wrinkle to that, which is when you forget your password, there's usually some other measure. For example, you know, your favorite pet animal or your who is your mother's name type of questions in order to reestablish who you are and then to allow you to create a new password. And that is a vulnerability too. These questions are very often things that you can pick up off the web very easily, and so I always feel nervous about organizations that want me to provide extra questions in case I forget my password.
Yeah, this is a huge issue, and there are many places that are moving away from asking you questions. What we're moving toward, there's a large project going on right now at the university to simplify people's experience in logging onto systems. And, you know, currently, whereas your campus may provide a single password and login that gets you into everything, at a system level, it may be different, your enterprise ID. So there's a project going on to unify all that into one credential at the university. And to be frank, part of where we're really looking the most in that project initially is the password reset question. How do we enable people to self-service themselves? Because we have, you know, 70,000 students across the system, and it's a huge load on the help desks to have answer these calls. And it goes to the heart of our question, is that when you start allowing password resets over the phone, unless you're very confident about how you're authenticating that a person is who they say they are, the strength of your password is irrelevant at that point.
Well, resets are possible over the phone, because I would think that perhaps even resets over the internet could be vulnerable to being done by outside parties.
Right now, the practice differs across the campuses and university administration, and as far as password resets over the phone. And that's probably no other single issue we're trying to resolve in a positive way right now, is what to do about that. From a security perspective, we definitely don't want to, we would prefer not to see password resets done over the phone. However, from a customer service perspective, and remember, we do have a lot of people like Roy who are in other places and can't walk into a help desk or may not be able to use one of the other self-service mechanisms for resetting their password. So we're trying to balance those two issues.
Professor Campbell, is there any alternative to passwords?
Well, you can carry an authentication device with you. That helps a lot, and that's what's used in most of the government security systems. Again, it's another thing that you could lose, but they're usually password protected. you have a single device that you have to take care of, which is perhaps a little bit better than having multiple passwords and so on.
We're not getting to the point of, say, computers that read fingerprints or take retinal scans or anything like that?
Oh, they're around. I mean, there is some use of biometric methods of authenticating people at the university.
At the university? Well, what sort of level do you do that in?
Those are in highly secure data centers where there might be fingerprint readers or retinal scanners, things like that. The problem with these technologies is that, A, they're very expensive, typically. B, they require a lot of control of the technology. And in our environment where we have, say, 10,000 new students coming to campus every year bringing their own equipment, it's hard to mandate something that has a very specific technical requirement. Plus, people don't like these things. They tend to find them difficult to use. They're not as reliable. Fingerprint readers aren't as good in terms of successfully reading your fingerprint as we'd like. So you have a lot of challenges around these devices right now.
And the data from them is eminently stealable.
That's right.
So you have another way of funding black market negotiations.
That's right. You can steal my password and I can get a new one. But if you steal my fingerprint, it's a little difficult to replace that.
Same would be actually with your genetic. You know, if you could read the genes.
That will be the next step along the line, it sounds like it. We have a caller with us now, and this is David in Champaign-Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
The recovery question that a lot of sites, even banks, demand, could you evade the problem with that by entering my favorite pet, and then a series of random numbers, letters, and
that's exactly what we recommend for those questions. Is if they ask you the name of your favorite pet, make up something that is not guessable and unrelated to the name of your favorite pet.
Maybe not absolute nonsense. I think Matt Honan suggests something entirely fictional and fantastic, like maybe if you wrote fire breathing dragon or something like that as your favorite pet. It would be something that people would not expect, as long as you don't have any evidence lying around that you have a soft spot for fire-breathing dragons. That's the sort of thing that would work.
That's right. But it
becomes difficult, though, because then you have to remember.
Yeah.
And if you have 30 passwords and you have, say, 90 questions that you can answer, you're getting into where do you write it all down?
That's right.
What I usually do, if I can, for an important password is pick the first and last initials of a set of, say, four people and combine that with numbers and well, exclamation points or question marks or something of that sort. It seems to me that the first last initial scheme, particularly if it's randomly upper or lower case, should be as difficult as truly random numbers.
The only thing I'd say is I think you're doing the right thing by approaching it this way. And if it's the answer for a security question, that's even more beneficial. But it's important to point out that anything shorter than 8 to 12 characters these days can be guessed fairly quickly given the computational power that mm-hmm. is available to the average user.
I usually use at least 10 digits.
Yeah. One of the things we've considered moving to, some of our peers have moved to, are the use of passphrases instead of passwords. And a passphrase would be something, say, on the order of 25 characters. It wouldn't be a long password, unless you wanted it that way. It would be more like a nonsense sentence. Because once you get to 25 characters, somewhere in that length, it'll take many years for people to try every permutation of something that long.
If you're using a password vault, that would be particularly useful with mm-hmm. that long password.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer of password vaulting.
Do password vaults also require passwords?
They sure do.
Okay, then.
But it's one password for 35 passwords.
Right, and the password vault I use about a 50-character phrase as the authentication to get in. So it's very unlikely that's going to be hacked.
Are there any recommendations on password vaults?
The two that we recommend in particular on campus now are one called KeePass.
KeePass?
KeePass. KeePass, I believe. It's a small...
KEE.
I think so.
Not KEY, but KEE.
Yeah, I may have that wrong. Someone will correct me.
KeePass, not PPass.
Right, with a K. And it's a open source password vault product that's very nice. The other one that I really like is LastPass. And LastPass is cloud-based. There's both a fee and a commercial version, free and a commercial version. And it encrypts your data out in the cloud, and it integrates. It doesn't store it locally on your machine, but it integrates with your browser. So it can, it's very convenient as you're going from website to website.
It apparently is KEEPASS, unless, of course, this is the... one of the fishing expeditions that might be on the misspellings of the phrase. But it has an entry in Wikipedia, which is promising.
Good.
One of the difficulties with everything, with all of this is that you do need to change your passwords fairly often. And so
how often
you have a vault?
Well, on campus at the university, we require the passwords to be changed annually. And the logic here is that your password should be formed in a way that it takes longer than the period it'll exist to hack it. So it used to be we used a year because we assumed for an 8 to 12 character password, it would take about a year to guess all the permutations of that. The reality is with modern computing power, that's probably too long a period to leave it. But you're back to that inconveniencing people issue. If we force people to change their password every 30 days, like, say, the state does for their employees, you would end up in a situation where people were forgetting it more often, using weaker passwords, or writing it down inappropriately.
If you used longer passwords, that would permit longer periods of time that the password be in effect?
Yeah, I'm kind of the mind, if we can get there, that we move to passphrases or some sort of similar system, and then for at least, say, the student accounts, which are bring less risk to the institution, extend the reset period to, say, a couple of years.
Well, thank you very much. I did wonder, did you have any problems with this recent IPS hacking of Spam House? I think I got my acronym wrong.
We didn't have any issues here with people attacking Spam House.
Well, I mean similar attacks where they...
The denial of service?
Yeah, apparently some of the servers, the ID servers, aren't configured properly and
We do see denial of service attacks against the campus periodically, not as often as we used to. But just a couple of weeks ago, we had a rather significant one launched at the campus website. I think at the end of the day, we tallied up around 60,000 computers participating in that attack.
Oh, God. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, David. And you brought up Spam House, which is a new one for me, but obviously not to an awful lot of people, since I'm looking at an article now in today's New York Times, an escalating cyber attack involving an anti-spam group and a shadowy group of attackers has now affected millions of people across the Internet, raising the question, how can such attacks be stopped? The short answer is not easily.
Yeah, there are some attacks that are launched against us that we have technology that will solve the problem. There are others that all you can really do is build robust systems and wait for them to stop. There's no magic bullet for every one of these attacks. It's not just a question of throwing money at it.
One of the issues, of course, is that when there are internecine wars on the Internet, it affects other people. There's an impact for everyone. And I think that's what you're seeing with the Spam House effort. And I read figures that they were actually producing something like 300 gigabits per second of denial of service attack, mm-hmm. which is really, that's a record.
Yeah, that would just simply completely clog our connections to the Internet.
And a short summary, according to the New York Times, is that security engineers say that an anonymous group unhappy with Spam House, which is a volunteer organization that distributes a blacklist of spammers to email providers, had retaliated against Spam House with a cyber attack of vast proportions, those denial of service attacks.
And this is what I was referring to is earlier on. But you can also see that if a number of individuals or organizations felt really objected to something that was going on the Internet, they might just sort of, by association, create an attack on some entity that could really be nasty. On the botnet type of attack, the denial of service attack, those botnet attacks can be purchased.
Oh, yeah.
So there are organizations out there that will sell you so many thousand botnet attacks. And they have a botnet that they can just tune to actually do that attack. So it's becoming very sophisticated. And
it's commodity.
Commodity. And the ramifications of it, that we haven't really sort of thought out how to defend ourselves against such sort of complexity.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about cybersecurity from Michael Korn and Professor Roy Campbell. You can call 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have Michael on the phone from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
A little puzzled at the concern over strings of passwords relating to the computing power that could be brought to bear to crack them. Doesn't that presuppose that you've got access to the hashed password? And typically when you're online, you get your password wrong three or four times, it shuts you down. It only gives you four tries.
No, you're absolutely right. One of the standard ways in which you prevent these brute force attacks against a password is you only allow so many tries. We also frequently build systems that throttle how fast you can try a password, or we lock your account. But it is very common for hackers to get into a system, steal those password hashes, and then take them offline and work on breaking them. So, I mean, we're blending different sorts of attacks here.
Okay, so that's the ultimate concern is actually a double cracking, so to speak, that they crack you and steal the shrouded passwords and then start cracking away on them.
Yeah, that's largely it. However, you know, we live in a world where, you know, probably during this show, there's been 15 new startups coming out of Silicon Valley offering really nifty and cool web services. And I can tell you from looking at some of these, not all of them are doing the kind of security practices that we've talked about. So, you know, I hate to say this, but really the best defense against some of these things is just to become a more savvy digital citizen.
Right. Okay. Well, it seems to me some of these really incredible throw in 27 different kinds of characters and so on gets a bit beyond the human's ability to remember this stuff. And then you end up with these vulnerabilities through the resetting the password systems.
Well, I think there's another point that was made in Wired magazine that you want to be very careful for a particular account, how easy it is to break into that account and what is the risk to you of someone doing that. And I think, obviously, from the Wired magazine author's point of view, it was a surprise that all of his photographs of his daughter could be removed. And that could have been remedied by backing up all those photographs.
Mm-hmm.
I think every time you do some, every time you create a new account, every time you get a new facility, you've got to ask yourself, and what happens if someone breaks into that account? Is that going to cause me a devastating blow, and can I redeem it in some other way?
Excellent
diversity
point.
Is always a good thing.
Yep.
A bit of a cost-benefit analysis. Well, anyway, this has been a very interesting discussion, and I appreciate the program.
Thank you, Michael. We have a tweet in from Taylor, who asks, how do you weigh student and faculty privacy, I guess this is a question for you, Michael,
mm-hmm.
versus the need to secure and inspect packets?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's one, actually I gave a talk at a conference earlier this, or last summer on this very issue. There's the conflict I have wearing two hats, both the campus privacy officer hat and the campus security officer hat, is that many of the things we need to do to secure the network, on the face of them, appear to fly in the face of the privacy we'd like to extend to our community. And I think what's important is that at Urbana, and I think this is true throughout the entire Illinois system, we extend greater privacy protections and greater respect for privacy to our institution than I think the law actually requires for faculty and staff. The way we handle this mechanically, though, is that when we do need to access very sensitive data, such as network traffic data, the sites you're going to, the activity on the network, we restrict access to that to the greatest degree possible. And really, it's only used in the context of identifying attacks on the campus, vulnerable machines. It's not distributed. And if you look at the campus appropriate use policy, which defines what you can and can't do with digital content, you'll see that there are strong protections extended to members of the campus community, ensuring that data is not casually accessed.
We have another email that came in from Kathleen, and this is Kathleen's password strategy. Using lines of songs or poems which have naturally occurring internal capital letters, plus some digits in her example, the Yellow Rose of Texas plus 1066, TYROT, capitalize the T's, 1066. Is that something that's, can you use the initials of familiar songs or phrases? And can you use familiar numbers? 1066 is the date of the Norman Conquest. Some hackers might figure that one out.
So,
is that too easy to search for?
Well, the problem I would raise is that you can gradually form, if you like, an impression of what a particular individual would create in the way of passwords. If you can get hold of some examples, and one of the issues is to make sure that all of your passwords are always removed from your system completely in some way. always delete everything. And the trouble is you have to generate lots of different passwords. And whether you could actually analyze the way that people do that, I think is a is still an interesting question. But so far, I don't think that technique's been developed very well by the hackers. Michael, do you want to address that?
Well, I would say that many of the things we've traditionally told people, such as substitute a zero for an O, things like this, the hackers are onto. They have algorithms to try to generate this. So the more rigorous you can get about making that password as complex as possible is a good thing, but false confidence is a bad thing as well here.
This is a lot more to come and a lot more worries and thinking in the area of cybersecurity. So your job sounds pretty secure, Michael.
I enjoy it.
Also, job security for you, Professor Campbell. Thank you very much for being on the program today. And I'm sorry that we're out of time. Our apologies to a caller that was waiting. We've been talking about cybersecurity with our guests, U of I computer science professor Rory Campbell and Michael Korn, the university's chief information security officer. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus, likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Focus is aired live weekday mornings at 10 on AM 580 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can also hear us streamed online at will.illinois.edu, where you can listen to years of past programs. Tomorrow on Focus, astronomy for beginners. All you need is a clear night, some time to look up at the stars, and some advice from astronomer Jim Kaler. We'll learn about what to look for in the sky this spring, so, plus some facts about asteroids and that meteor, the one that exploded near the Russian city of Chelyabinsk last month in Siberia. Today's edition of Focus was produced by Lindsay Moon with assistance from Allison Marcott. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Mike Pritchard is our technical director today, handling your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. You've been listening to Focus on WILL AM 580, Illinois Public Media.